So first, thanks for coming and thanks for giving me the opportunity in this nice workshop to present some of the stuff I do. So as you all can read, I'm going to talk about quantum coherent energy transfer and photosynthesis. And I know this title is asking for criticism. So if I would not ask for it, I might have put here a question mark. But I really would like that we discuss this topic. I think it's new and it's only little stuff done and people claim many things and it's still unclear what's really true and what's not true right now. So ask whenever there is a question coming up. Maybe I can answer it. So let me first explain, when I say photosynthesis, that's old business and it's a process chain with 100 different processes. And when I talk about it, I'm only taking the first four steps in this whole chain to discuss with. So let's look at the photosynthetic complexes which you find in purple bacteria. They usually live underwater, somewhere under low light conditions. So people are studying them and they think these are the most efficient ones in harvesting light, basically. So what you find there is you have these ring structures, small ones, which surround a bigger one. And in the bigger one, you have something which is called the reaction center. So if you go in bigger on this, all these ones here are now really chlorophylls. So they are actual sites where light could be absorbed and an exciton formed. So when light is absorbed, let me say, these things actually have two rings. So there's an inner ring and an outer ring. Usually the process starts that light is absorbed in the outer ring. So on one of these chlorophylls, light is absorbed. An electron is moving from the ground state to an excited state, but the electronic charge is coupled strongly to the hole it left behind. So the electron is not moving away. It's really an exciton, and only the energy is moving along to other ones by a kind of dipole-dipole coupling. So the second step really is then that from these outer rings, it jumps to the inner rings. From the inner rings, it jumps then from ring to ring until it reaches this LH1 system.
What jumps?
That's a big question. So when I say jump, that's what everyone was saying 5 years ago and was just totally incoherent classic jumps. And this is what now is under discussion, if that picture is really right. And some experiments suggest that quantum mechanics is involved. But we come to that later, shortly later. So right now, the last step here is really that this energy jumps into the reaction center. There, finally, the excitonic energy, so the exciton, which is then in the reaction center, will be split. The electron does, I think, two more steps, and then water is split. And with the proton, the plants do whatever they want to do on a later time scale.
So you asked for interruptions.
Yes.
The first step, the H nu exciting an electron in the outer ring.
Yes.
And you say the electron stays there, and so what, it decays, and then
it's a dipole-dipole coupling.
Dipole-dipole problem. So you excite another one in another ring.
Right.
And that excitation propagates through all these things there.
Right.
Till it comes.
Until it basically ends up here, and then the exciton splits first, so we have an electron, and the electron is used for a chemical reaction in general.
Okay, I understand.
So what happens with exciton on the last step?
In here?
Yeah. With produced electron.
There it goes to what the chemists and the biologists call the special pair, and that's where the exciton is ripped apart. So it's really
the electron holds it.
Yeah, then the electron hops away and the hole stays where it is.
Then you combine with another electron.
Yeah. So this is a process of which I have no big knowledge, I have to say. But that's how the standard view is. This standard view is nothing new. I mean, this is, I think, 15 years old or even older. And there's a puzzle to it, which is also not new. It's also old knowledge. This excitonic transfer works without loss. There is some loss. It's not no loss, but the efficiency is about 95%. Basically meaning that the recombination time of a single exciton is about a nanosecond. Whereas the whole time it takes from here, so from somewhere here, jumping until it reaches here is a couple of picoseconds, not more. And it's totally unclear why is that the case. No one knows. So
what's the distance of total distance of travel?
I think a diameter here is about 10 angstroms. Hand waving.
So question. That's too big. That's far too big. I mean, these are complex molecules.
What is 10 angstroms? 10 angstroms probably is 1 ring. Even less than 1 ring.
Even the small ones are proteins. Even the small ones are some more proteins than they are much more
than 10. I know the distances in the FMO, but the FMO is this is green bacteria. There, the shortest hopping distance you have between two of such things is 3.8 angstrom. And you have to go over two channels, so the whole FMO is about 8, 9, 10 angstrom. It has 7 chromophores, yeah. So this might be twice as large, 20. It's not hundreds.
Is the structure of the big ring the same supposed to be the structure of the small ring, only more of these round molecules?
Yes, yes.
By coherent energy transfer, you mean the transfer of the exciton or the transfer of the final electron, which might...
Of the exciton, okay. So of the energy. So...
If I just look at your picture, the distance between adjacent points would be 3 angstroms. So then just...
I mean, from here to here, it's much more.
That's okay. Yeah. Maybe 10 nanometers, which is 100 angstroms.
But now let me show you the experiments. And I'm not going too deep into detail, since I know something about them, but not really much. I'm not an experimentalist. So I have kind of to believe what they tell me. What they do is ultra-fast 2D photon echo spectroscopy, basically. Meaning that they're shining in a laser, and they excite one of these sites, and they are able to look at a different site and see if there is an excitation over there. And they can look at that over time and see what's happening. So now, the thing I've just showed you, the purple bacteria, there's one experiment done in there. This experiment actually is not done just to make that clear. So this experiment is done in this system and not somewhere over here. And this system was chemically modified that the exciton would not separate, so the electron would not hop off. So basically in here you have 3 sites where the exciton could be, and that's what they were looking at.
What is the wavelength of the laser?
In that experiment, it must be visible light.
So if it's visible light, how can you have a special resolution of 10 angstroms or a few tens of angstroms? Because you said that you excite one site and you measure it.
They don't do it spatially. I think they do it energetically. So this is this two-colorway of thing. They basically shine in a laser which, so a laser light which they cut in several pieces, then they do delays in it. They excite the system with the first one, the second one goes in, and then they do basically a Fourier spectrum of what they get out in the end. And from that, they try to tell us which excitations were excited at which time. So it's all, I think, only works when you know which excitation lines you have, which they have done in Previous experiment, where they simply made absorption spectroscopy for the lines.
The X scale is in picoseconds?
This is femtoseconds.
Femtoseconds.
Yes, this is femtoseconds. So what they now see in this reaction center is these data points. This is done at 77 Kelvin, so it's not at room temperature. So the conclusion was, this is a wave-like quantum coherent motion.
So can you say it again, because it's important. How do you see that this is coherent?
Let's go to this one. This is the one I've described to you. Yes. Since in principle they are the same, but here I know it a little better, and it shows it better. So this is the energy they are exciting. And this is the energy of another of these excitonic sites. They do not all have the same energy and stuff. So, and the wiggling which you see overlaid on here should be inverse to the one you see here. That's what they're finding. And so the idea is that the exciton, which is at this energy, which means at this site, moves back and forth between these two. This is their conclusion from this experimental data.
So they have time resolution?
This is time, and this is energy, and this is amplitude. This is femtoseconds. It's hard to say here. It's, I think, 800 femtoseconds.
It's luminescence, right? What is on the vertical axis? It's intensity of luminescence.
It's the intensity of the photon echo for a certain. They take the photon echo and then they split this up into the frequencies. But in principle, they are just measuring. Yeah, the intensity of the laser light coming out.
What's the temperature on the experiment on the left?
It's also 77 Kelvin. So these were the two experiments done in 2007. And so this
is a period of oscillation like the coherent tunneling time of the exciton. Is that the picture?
That's the picture, yes.
And you were saying that there's evidence that it tunnels between three sites. What is that evidence?
Two. This is two. Here it is hard to say, but I wouldn't necessarily claim that it's more than two.
Where is that evidence coming?
Here, the way it's done, you have three sites, but one is very unlikely that it would be the case since they did this chemical modification thing. So you. In principle, the argument is you only have two sites. It's going to be a tunneling between the two sites, if it is tunneling.
It's something I know from chemistry, from the structure of the molecule.
Do they see a damping of these radio oscillations?
There's an envelope.
In the left one.
Here. Yeah, kind of. They extract from this behavior and it dies out. But see, what you would like to see is cosine behavior, right? Something like that. What they then see is something like that. It's not so direct and clean that you simply could say, well, it's this or it's that.
So basically, would be that there were more sites involved.
I mean, this is in the FMO. In the FMO, there are seven sites. But see, I am a little hesitant to now claim we have coherent motion between seven sides, just because this is wiggling that much. There's more than one frequency involved. Yes, I agree.
What is the parameter C?
We come to that later back again, but here, I mean, they try to explain their data, and what they said is, or the standard picture is always you have these chromophore excites, you describe them as a two-level system, they are embedded in a protein, and so you say each of these chromophores has its own environmental things. So you give each of them environmental fluctuations, separate ones. This would be the naive first step. And then you can say, well, now these could be correlated. And if you correlate them perfectly, I mean, so you have basically, you have two sites where your excitation could be, here or here. So if the fluctuations are totally correlated, so the energies do this, this wouldn't cohere the process. And this is what they plugged in here. So they simply said, well, if I do this correlation up to a factor of 0.9, then my theory would give what the experiment shows. It's not the standard picture to explain it at the moment, I have to say. It might have been 3 years ago, but...
I'm just asking what structure of the excitron. Is it electron hole which are sitting at the same site, or it is possible that electrons sit in one site, hole in another site, and then when you model the distance between them, you also produce such a thing?
I think the picture is at one site. But I think it's a picture, it's not knowledge.
But if it's on different sides, then just oscillations of atoms you produce with it.
Okay, well, let's now first give some arguments why this creates tons of noise around. I mean, terms like quantum biology are termed now and written everywhere. So let's give us first the technology-wise thing why this is interesting. As I said, this high yield in the transport, that the excitonic transport is without loss, that is very interesting for the organic solar cell business. The organic solar cells suffer mainly from one problem. They cannot transport excitons very well. So if we would first understand how photosynthesis does it, second, would be able to copy that into a solar cell, then we would be very happy. And the second noise certainly comes from that, quantum mechanics and something like photosynthesis, which has something to do with life, is a combination not everyone really likes. And I think the first question one should ask after we've settled that the experiments are really facts, hard facts, and there are no questions about it anymore, which I will for the rest of the talk just assume, then you still have to answer the question, is this just a coincidence of energy and time scales? Or does it really serve any purpose? I mean, did nature really use this? Which is, well, also totally unclear right now.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
How do you know that these are Rabi oscillations as opposed to some classical energy exponent is essentially classical energy that runs back and forth, gets reflected back and forth?
If it would be classical, I mean, it would be random. It wouldn't really be what they call a wave-like behavior.
Ball going between two walls is not really random.
But it wouldn't be that. I mean, it's hopping. It's either incoherent hopping or quantum mechanical tunneling, right? I mean, the exciton itself is a quantum mechanical quantity.
Sure. You created it by absorbing light. This is the quantum mechanics. But now you have some entity which runs back and forth. So how do I know that this entity is not moving just classically as opposed to Rabi oscillations.
But for classically moving, you need more than a single site. I mean, this is really, you have two or three sites, and it must hop between them, or seven.
Sides.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have seven sites. Can't they just, flow back and forth classically?
Not with the energy scales you have. If you modify all that to get it this way, I mean, it would work, but you know the energies of the single sites. And you know the distances, and with basically Förster type coupling, they calculate the transfer elements. With that, it would not work anymore. That wouldn't give you that.
But now this is very sensitive on the model you use, yes? I mean, you can invent a model where everything is classical.
Probably, but
it's classical, it would be either ballistic motion or random hopping and harmonic potential.
Well, ballistic. I mean, ballistic. Is,
but in that case, we'll not see ballistic.
Okay,
random ones. Ballistic
is the first one. Sound waves.
But I have
just traveled.
Sound waves.
Yeah. Like you go to the ocean, you go to the swimming pool.
First slide.
Yeah.
This one.
Yeah. I have a little bit of a problem with the uncertainty principle. I mean, how can you then say where the light is absorbed?
You cannot. It's a picture. I mean, see,
And your thing was that one outer ring absorbed the energy somehow.
These could absorb in the same way.
Let me just.
I've been a collective excitation. Does it have to be?
Even
I'm just trying to think about the uncertainty principle. You know, here you are kind of localizing where it happens, but on the other hand, does this model satisfy the uncertainty principle? That's my
The model I've described when I described this thing never try to do that. Then that's a classical model. See, you excite something and then it hops. That the whole thing that these are strongly coupled and that people believe that excitons in this ring are actually delocalized over more than one of these little things. So they believe they are delocalized. So all these questions, they are fairly new. Some people propose them, make experiments, other people argue against them. Every time you use the word quantum in this picture, someone will tell you, no, not this way, you have to do it this way, and then quantum you can forget. The picture I've painted is purely classical.
I'd like to clarify something which we already discussed. Is it correct from this picture that exciton travels 100 angstroms before decoherence takes place?
No.
But this whole thing is 100 angstroms, right?
Yes. No? But no one is claiming, no one claims so far. I mean, see, now whatever someone is claiming somewhere, there is no experiment showing that an exciton is formed here and it's coherently going over here.
Oh.
No experiment. The experiments we have is between two sites in here.
But you cite exciton in this red square, right? No?
No. Even in that experiment, it's really, they take...
But,
they
then
take
it,
not,
but if you cite them there, it travels...
It travels over here.
From this to there, with a minimal loss of energy, that's what he said.
Then how do you do echo?
Echo is done.
The experiment is only on the
inner part.
In the echo.
Echo is in the red side.
No. The experiment.
Can you explain to me how the echo works then?
Okay, in the experiment, they chemically take out this
only
part. Many of them. The whole sample is only a bunch of these. And then they modify each single one of these.
So they take out all the three.
All the rest
is
gone.
It's a completely artificial experiment.
Yeah. This is one experiment and the other one of the FMO.
Okay.
Let's paint how in the FMO it works. or not in the, in the green bacteria. So in the green bacteria, you kind of, all these antenna things, they are in some huge bunch. So here you have tons of these antenna rings. And then you combine them to the reaction center, which is here. And this is an FMO complex. So in the second experiment, so in this one, what they do is they cut out this little piece and do the experiments on these, on a bunch of these. But this is gone, all this is gone, all the rest of the plant is gone. And so these two newer experiments, I think this one really now does something in the rings, but I'm still sure it takes single LH2 rings or single LH1 rings, so it's not over the huge distances. And this one, the cryptophyte marine algae, I think is a system which has 8 chromophores, so it has 8 sites. It's small systems which they look at.
So can you say again, what is the time scale of these oscillations?
This stuff here, it's femtoseconds, so hundreds of femtoseconds.
How is it compared to the vibrational mode of these molecules?
This is now a really tricky question. Lens. I mean, the protein has a whole spectrum. And this is what's now believed is doing the trick. So it gives you a continuous spectrum which is limited to frequencies which are smaller than this. And then you have a couple of specific frequencies. Well, now there starts now again a discussion with the chemists always too. The question is if that frequency is identical to the one you find here or not, which then it's old knowledge that you can have long time coherence between an electronic excitation, these excitons, and single vibrational modes. That's known for 10, 15 years, and it's observed. So the trick is to get a system where there is no vibrational mode close by to your electronic excitation. And by a bunch of other experiments, these people say they can make sure that in this case, everything is purely electronic.
Can you trust the experiment?
That's a question I cannot answer.
So what's the statement that there is no vibrational motion which is close to what frequency?
To the oscillation frequency here. Oh. Or to the excitonic jumping frequencies, yeah.
How do they know the whole spectrum of vibrational modes of this complex object?
Aren't those typically on the scale of picoseconds?
Pardon?
Aren't the periods of vibrational motion on the scale of picoseconds? And you said this was femtoseconds.
It's hundreds of femtoseconds, so, and yeah, I think usually the proteins have high energy vibrations too, which could be in the same range. So it's not trivial. You have to verify it experimentally that a certain situation does not show you these vibrational coherences.
Is it understood why the excitons don't recombine and re-radiate?
No, this is the big puzzle. Oh, they do, but very slowly, and it's not really clear why transport is so much faster than that. Okay. So I've tried to motivate you why this is interesting. Now, I've learned today that this is now a little bit more complicated question than I thought it would be. But let's go through the argument anyway. So the question, is it really that surprising what we see? And let's first give an argument why it is surprising. I mean, the biggest electronic coupling you have in this FMO complex now, it's between the two closest of the chromophores. That's 100 wave numbers. I usually like to think in temperature, so that's something like 150 Kelvin. Saying this, room temperature is nothing. It's just twice this energy. I mean, room temperature is not going to destroy quantum coherence. So, but we have an environment. I mean, saying room temperature, we have an environment. Now, the environmental fluctuations are really very strongly coupled to these chromophores. So, if you put that in a one phonon rate with Markov or Golden Rule, what you certainly figure out is your dynamics is overdamped, it's purely classical.
No, no, but before you go to environment, you need to ask what is the spectrum? I mean, the coupling is only part of the puzzle. I mean, if the level spacing...
But you're spoiling my argument. You're perfectly right. I mean, it's the answer. It's the answer in that. But I mean, when I did this, then I was also thinking, I mean, knowing the spectrum, no one should be that surprised. If everything the experimentalists gave us before this coherence experiment, then you should have told them you should find that. But people did not. So something people missed, and I was assuming they missed exactly the point you was mentioning. Something must be wrong here. And it comes on the end of this slide. So just hold on a minute. When you try to make the simplest you can, I mean, take two of these chromophoric things. So you have two-level systems. When you now even say that the recombination of such an exciton is totally negligible on the time scales we want to discuss, then all you have to discuss is the exciton is either here or here. So it's a two-level system, nothing else. And now we want to decohere this tunneling process from the two sides. So we couple it each to its own environment, and each chromophore has its own protein, its own environmental modes. And that's the simplest non-trivial thing you can do. You kind of have to discuss, this goes back to the discussion before of correlated fluctuations, what kind of fluctuations you want to take. Do you take propagating modes or localized modes? It's not the big difference. It changes somehow these things. And I come back to that later. But the main part of the spectrum you need is you have a coupling constant. It's believed to be ohmic, so it's linear in the frequency. I say it's believed. There are various approaches in the literature to describe what they usually get these things from is line shape experiments. So they make absorption lines of these visible frequencies, and from the widths they try to get back the vibration spectrum this chromophore sees. And many use a Debye spectrum, so which is ohmic, but it has a different cutoff than as the one I'm writing down here. But others use other functions as well. But the important part really is this omega c, so that's the maximal frequency. And that is, from the experiments they have, they get that this omega c is of the order and sometimes smaller than this electronic coupling. So, and this is the whole trick. I mean, very naively, this should tell you everything. If you have no phonons, a one phonon process does not work. So then the spectrum is suppressed, you suppress decoherence. It's a little more complicated here than if you really want to solve that kind of model now for such a situation, then pictures like the one phonon process will break down. And especially because the coupling usually here is big. But the final result is at least qualitatively the same.
What does Camille just say about how well phonons are determined in this system? In water, for example, there are no phonons, right? So I mean, it's a rat, no
lie. I mean,
excitations are not photons.
Yeah, but that wouldn't necessarily matter here. Then, if you call them phonons or not, this is for me right now only a word. I mean, if you do the propagating ones or the localized ones, doesn't do the big difference here. You just need a spectrum of fluctuations. And this is what...
spectrum of fluctuations in a liquid is bigger than in solid, right? At room temperature.
That is true. So, yes. Yes.
So if it's in solid, it doesn't decay. So in liquids, they should decay more effectively.
The thing to answer is why... I mean, this and the spectra, they basically get out of these line shape experiments. So you need to explain where does these line shapes come from. But if you just take them...
But the experiment is done in solution, in water, or is it crystallized, or what?
Okay.
I mean, it's very different, right?
It's twofold. So the 77 Kelvin ones, I think, are done in glycerin. So the stuff is in a glycerin solution, and I assume glycerin is solid at 77 Kelvin. Does anyone know that? Or is it still liquid? I wouldn't know. But certainly the room temperature experiments are in a liquid, and that's room temperature. It's a liquid phase. They are swimming around in the sand.
Usually line widths of ions, or optical line widths in liquid, is 0.1 electron volt something. Are you saying that it's much narrower line widths here, 0.1 electron volts? So typically it's this, right?
I cannot give you the numbers, really.
That's what you see.
Okay, so next slide is a little technical. This is technically seen as a spin boson model, and it's non-trivial. And in these limits, we want to look at it. It's not solvable. So
just to summarize, you're saying that it is in a liquid, but for some reason, which we don't know, the coupling to the liquid is very weak.
The coupling is strong, but the fluctuation spectrum that chromophores actually see is rather limited. This is the trick.
If the coupling is huge, like Roy says, 0.1 electron, then the line width should be huge and no coherence should be
enough. Well,
he's saying that line width is much narrower.
When I say a large coupling, I mean that alpha is between 0.1 and 1. This is where I come in with large coupling. The way you are naming it, I couldn't give you numbers. This is the problem. If you transfer it into what the chemists do, they argue about reorganization energies. And correlation times in the bars, then usually the correlation times, this is what then comes to the omega c, is of the order of the 1 over delta. And the reorganization energy is actually rather on the small side. So if you like to take the reorganization energy as a measure of coupling strength, it would be weak. But that's somehow in this model, alpha times omega c. So alpha can still be large and omega c is just small. Might not. Okay. So let's get quick.
They know absorption or emission. It's absorption or it's emission.
The line width, I think, is absorption. Okay, let's go quickly over this. So we're using a numerical method to actually solve the spin boson problem I've just showed you. What we want to get is the time evolution for the statistical operator for the system alone. We are not interested in the time evolution of the fluctuations. So we want to integrate out all the fluctuations. The way we do that is we do a trotter slicing of the time evolution, which then allows us basically to take all the time evolution of the system alone to the front, and we put everything which comes from the coupling to the fluctuations into this little monster. It's Feynman-Vernon's influence functional. So this is old stuff. The influence functional is this. So all these sigmas are the possible states which you have in all these time cuts you introduced. And then you have to sum over all of these possibilities. The important thing in this is these little atoms here that are the Bass correlation functions. So there is really the point where the effect of the environmental fluctuations enter the dynamics of the system. This is totally exact if you make your trotter time zero, which then lets this n goes to infinity, and then everything is fine. This is certainly not what we can do with our computer. So we are always sticking with a finite trotter time, and we are rearranging these terms also, though, that we throw away all Bass correlations which look at the correlation time longer than a time we set for us. So we say in the Bass we only expect the memory for a time tau, and then we say whenever this j minus l times delta t, that's what this thing would look at, it's getting bigger than this tau, we say this is certainly zero, then there is no correlation beyond the memory time. That's an approximation. Certainly, numerically, you increase your tau step by step, you decrease delta t at the same time, and you try to find a convergent region where you then trust what you get as a result. That's the method. In principle, it's numerically exact. If you have bigger and bigger computers, you can do it more and more accurate. In real life, it's a numerical method with all the problems these things have. So if you then just do the occupation difference between the donor and the acceptor, when you initially started in the donor, for this problem, you plot this over time, and for different omega c's, then you get exactly what we just discussed. I mean, if omega c is large, you have some decay, and if omega c gets smaller, the decay is much slower. And it's more or less, you deplete the spectrum, so the one phonon process dies out, then you need to have multi-phonon processes. They are weaker, and they will die out as well if you go with omega c smaller and smaller. So this is one thing. Then what you also can do is for a fixed omega c, you can now play this game with the correlated fluctuations. So you have two sides. If you have propagating modes, then the quantity which basically determines if the fluctuations at both sides are correlated or not is the speed of sound. Small speed of sound is uncorrelated, large speed of sound is correlated. And so now it runs this way. So this is now, I think here I've really used the parameters more or less taken from the FMO complex. So you see, for a very short speed of sound, so uncorrelated stuff, fast decay, it's still going to 1 picosecond, but that's simply because I've chosen the omega c in the specific way, and if you have large correlations, the decay takes much longer to work through. The same holds if you do it with localized vibrations with a certain localization length. Then the quantity giving you if something is low is correlated or not is basically this correlation length you've put in. Just here, I mean, we've started doing this, and then we've started some discussion, is phonons really the right picture? I mean, there are certainly propagating modes, and if you look at water and you try to figure out what's the speed of sound and stuff like that, in water it is 1800 meters per second, so it's somewhere here. In ice, if that...
Water photons constitute very small portion of... Right, so it's just, it comes not from photons in water.
It's just for giving you scales. So the ice would be at 3,600. And I'm just saying if it would be propagating modes, then they are in a range where they make a difference. If you are considering ice or water, and the earliest experiments were done in something frozen. The question is such a correlated effect really relevant? The first experiment was analyzed in that way. They argued we need this correlation, but they did absolutely not use this argument that you have a small omega c. So then later in the next experiments, and the current postdoc with Graham Fleming basically argues it's a small omega c and this effect doesn't play a role. And all I'm trying to tell you is both effects could be in the right order. They could work. There's no proof this is the thing, as you say. I mean, you might argue that the spectra they extract from the other experiments are not that certain. It's just two mechanisms which suppress decoherence. And both mechanisms are not totally unrealistic. I would say they are fairly realistic. I think that's all. That's all for the first step. So taking what you get from experimentalists, I think you would expect some kind of coherence in the way they see it.
What about the effect of the coupling, of the strong coupling on the actual tunneling rate? I mean,
It's weak here. There's no big effect.
But for stronger coupling, in principle, you do expect that.
Yeah, you do expect it, but I couldn't tell you in what form. Since these things are typically, typical picture where this comes from is the Niebuhr result of the spin boson problem. But the Niebuhr result works for large omega c. So here we are at small omega c, so the Niebuhr wouldn't work. And even if you plug it into the Niebuhr, then the effects are not that big. So. Okay. I think the next couple of slides are much more technical and so probably much less interesting for you, so we might skip over them fairly quickly.
So just to see if I understood, you say essentially you look at a two-side problem of atomic scale essentially, and you said that essentially there are correlation in time, that it is coherent essentially, right?
Yes.
That's what you said. Now, how is it related to the whole process that you go from the outer ring inside? It's still, there is a big gap?
Yes, there's a big gap.
And we don't understand it still, right?
No.
I mean,
no.
But is there any puzzle there on actual? So here you say that there is a puzzle of oscillations. When two exciton jumps between two cases.
The puzzle is the high efficiency.
Yeah. Why there is noise about it? I think it's mainly these two.
It's
these two things. There's, for one thing, there's a lot of noise since there's this high yield in the transport, which is it's not understood. So, and when they found this quantum coherent stuff, they said, well, okay. Maybe that has something to do with each other. that was just a suggestion by Fleming, and it sparked many, many papers which flowed around. But there is no answer to that question yet. So, but this is, I mean, there's some hope here. I mean, if we could make our organic solar cells better, you really would solve a big problem. So people are excited, even though the chances might be tiny. And the second thing is that using in one single sentence a process connected to life and quantum mechanics, that by itself creates noise. And I perfectly agree, when you pin it down what the experiments really tell you, and then you look at the second page what photosynthesis does, there's still a huge gap. You cannot say photosynthesis is quantum mechanical or something like that. It's only, there is some quantum effect seems to be involved in what's happening in photosynthesis. If it's even relevant for photosynthesis, it's totally unclear.
How surprised should we be about this high efficiency? I mean, if you assume that it is just pure diffusion, that you have a classical object that is excited, that it's kind of diffusing along this ring, and gets trapped by this reaction center, what could be the kind of typical timescale that it would need to?
I'm certain it's possible, but I haven't seen this. I have not really looked into that.
Because if you think that this is the possible, but why it is so efficient, I mean, we should understand how inefficient it should be somehow.
And I'm certain this is done. I just haven't looked my way into that. So. Okay. So, well, I'm not sure how interested you are in the technical aspects. Here we did some work basically comparing the results of our numerics with a weak coupling approach, which basically tells us if you do this omega c small in the spin boson model, I mean, you have only multi-phonon processes. So this is a comparison which has nothing really to do with the photosynthesis connection, since we really went to very weak couplings. And even in a very weak coupling, the weak coupling approach fails. Since a weak coupling approach still takes as the main contribution of one phonon process. And that simply is suppressed by the spectrum. So you have to be careful. This is mainly an argument many people doing stuff right now in this field using Markov approximations or Redfield. And I'm always trying to tell them, if you do that, please be careful. Check that it works. Okay, this is the comparison between our method and another method. Getting the same result, I don't think there's a big point in discussing that here. So the next step, so then this is now going, where are we really? So when we believe that it's not surprising to see quantum coherence like it was seen in the experiment, if we believe that, then we still have all these questions to answer. Does it serve a purpose? Is there any function beneath it? Yeah, did evolution drive nature really to use that? I mean, it's just questions. It's not even clear if the questions are sensible right now. And the other whole branch of the business is this speculation by Fleming that the high efficiency in the transfer is caused by quantum coherence. That's a speculation. There are many works on that now. And my conclusion of all the works is there is no answer here. Each of these works gives more questions right now. What time do we have? How long did I talk?
Hour.
So I can go on. It is probably less interesting from the pure point of understanding these biological systems. The step we did from there is asking ourselves if there are functions. I mean, what could be there? So Since from our method we somehow limited to a few sites, so I cannot really do this complete wing structure. So we were saying, well, we've learned something from two sites. Let's take four sites. Let's take two of these donor acceptor systems. Since we have seen these correlated fluctuations do some effect, let's just try to understand what they would do on such a double donor acceptor system. And if you have such a double system, so you have two donors, each would have an exciton, which then can hop there, and so you can pull these far apart or bring them close, and you can make this distance large. So if you make this distance large, then you basically have distant channels. They should be independent. That's what we would expect. And if you bring them close, well, then they might communicate with each other. And it's what we basically find. It's not that exciting. I mean, if you have the distant channels, this picture is more or less the same I've showed you before. So this is now with speed of sound, but meaning here you have very weak correlations and the decay is faster, and here you have very strong correlations. That the whole effect looks much more coherent is in this picture only a fact of that we did it at a lower temperature. If I would go back to the same temperature I've showed you the picture before, it would be the same picture as before. This is now the picture for closed channels, and there the situation is vice versa. So they're really communicating. So uncorrelated fluctuations suppress the coherence less than correlated ones. We were for a minute excited about that, and then we looked at higher temperatures, and this effect goes away at higher temperatures. So this is nothing nature could be using, we think. Okay. So that was a piece of work we did. And at least, I mean, we've learned spatial correlation, correlated fluctuations can do both. They can suppress decoherence, as we've seen for the two sides, but under certain conditions, they could also enhance decoherence. Okay. The last thing I'm showing you is how should I explain why we looked at entanglement in these systems? The first paper showing this quantum stuff by the Fleming group, where they speculated it had something to do that the quantum mechanics would give rise to this superior yield. Their argument was that the exciton could do something like a quantum surge. And when this word quantum surge popped up in this, it was a science paper, I think all the quantum computing and quantum information people got alerted. So therefore, there is some hype in checking out what entanglement does in these systems, since that would facilitate such quantum search ideas. So the background basically is if you see that entanglement would be there and it would survive very long, then the speculation by Fleming might have some basis. That was the idea. So
experimental fact indicates that there may be some entanglement?
None. I'll be very honest here, none. It's really all based on this one speculation. It all goes back to these two experiments I've showed you from which it was concluded that there's quantum coherent oscillations. So nevertheless, we looked at it and it's basically the same. The negativity is a measure for entanglement, and you have again such double donor acceptor systems, and we start out of an unentangled state. And if your omega C is large, then nothing is happening. So the color code gives you the negativity, and by that way the entanglement. The point we made here is if omega C is really smaller than the electronic coupling, then you see an emergence of entanglement and a decay. For this plot, it's not even that surprising since we by hand introduced the coupling. But it's much more interesting to see it happening also here.
What should you measure in this system to check whether there is entanglement or not?
You would really need to measure a 2 exciton state in an FMO, for example, and see how it evolves through this system. Which, that would give you the only measure, since with a single exciton, an entanglement definition doesn't make sense. You need a 2 particle state for defining it properly.
But you don't know at the moment how to do that.
No, it's experimentally unclear, and it's a purely theoretical discussion at this point, where you would argue from all this quantum information knowledge, if entanglement would be supported in such an environment, then you could be able to start arguments how this could then facilitate a quantum search behavior for the exciton. But it's in an early step. And okay, so I think the surprising stuff is really here. Here, there was a direct coupling between these two. If you put this to zero, you get this, and you still see that entanglement is created by the bars. It also works for stronger coupling, so these are 2 different couplings. This is the stronger one. It still works. Theoretically, all it tells you is that a slow bars really helps you with entanglement. For the biological problem, right now it doesn't tell you anything. I think with that, I should thank you for your patience and all the people I've worked with. And I also have to tell you who is paying me. It's the excellence initiative of the German states and the federal government. But in detail, this was all done while I was at the Freiburg Institute for Advanced Studies, which is an institute founded by the money from this initiative. Thanks. Yeah, I've asked the same question. The problem is that when they shoot with the laser on the samples, they heat them. Basically, they repeat these experiments very often. If they do it at room temperature, basically they burn away the whole sample before anything they get out. If they do it at 77 Kelvin, they can ensure that the sample cools quickly enough that they can do it at a stable condition without destroying the chromophores. I mean, the chromophores, it's not really the problem of heating. It's the problem that when exciting chromophores and you excite them multiply, then basically they decay. So they die out. Even in nature, all these chromophores, we always view this as a nice static picture. I was told that usually within a day, all these systems are broken down and done newly. But there are new experiments at room temperature now. So, but don't ask me now how they solved this problem. All the questions are asked, I think we can close.